internet, and for a long time he didn't even tell me his name. He didn't want me to know he was a famous writer, because he thought I'd blackmail him, or sell my story to the Sunday newspapers or something. That's just silly. No one does that anymore. James only found out who he was when he saw Alan on Breakfast TV promoting one of his books. Actually, that rang a bell for me. When the Atticus Punt novels had started selling, Alan had done everything he could not to appear on television, the exact opposite, in fact, of all our other authors. At the time, I'd assumed he was shy, but if he was leading this double life, it made complete sense. We had finished the main course and both bottles and staggered out into the yard for a cigarette. It was a clear night, and sitting under the stars with a very pale sliver of a moon in the black sky, James became thoughtful. "I really liked Alan, you know," he said. "He could be a miserable old bastard, especially when he was writing one of his books. All that money he was making from his detective stories, it never seemed to make him happy. But I did. That's not such a bad thing, is it? Whatever people may think or say, he needed me. At first he just paid me for the night. Then we went on a couple of trips. He took me to Paris and Vienna. He told Melissa he was doing research. He even got me onto a book tour in America. If anyone asked, he said I was his PA, and we had separate rooms in every hotel. But of course they had adjoining doors. By that time he put me on an allowance, and I wasn't allowed to see anyone else. He blew out smoke, then gazed at the glowing tip of his cigarette. Alan liked watching me smoke, he said. After we'd had sex, I'd smoke a cigarette, naked, and he'd watch me. I'm sorry I let him down. How did you do that? I asked. I got itchy feet. He had his books and his writing, and I was getting bored sitting in Framlingham. I was more than 20 years younger than him, you know. There was nothing here for me. So I started going back to London. I said I was visiting friends, but Alan knew what I was doing. It was obvious. We had arguments about it, but I wouldn't stop. And in the end he threw me out, gave me a month to pack my bags. When you and I met, I was 2 days away from being homeless. Part of me had hoped we might have a reconciliation, but actually I was quite glad it was all over. I wasn't interested in the money. People looked at the two of us together, and they think that's all I cared about. But it's not true. I cared about him. We went back inside, and over several whiskies, James told me about his plans for the future, forgetting that he had already done so. He was going on a holiday for a while, somewhere hot. He was going to try acting again. I might even go to drama school. I can afford it now. Despite what he had said about Alan, he had already started another relationship, this time with a boy closer to his age. I don't know why, but looking at him as he sat at the table, with his long hair flowing and his eyes blurred by alcohol, I suddenly got the feeling that it wouldn't end well for him. It was a curious thought, but perhaps he had needed Alan Conway in much the same way as James Fraser had needed Atticus Punt. There was no other place for him in the story. He had come by car, but I wouldn't let him drive himself home, even if it was only a mile up the road. Feeling like an elderly aunt, I confiscated his keys and made the hotel call him a taxi. "I should stay here," he said. "I can afford a room. I can afford the whole hotel." They were the last words he spoke to me before he left, weaving uncertainly into the night. He used to hide things. James was right. In Gin and Cyanide, which is set in London, there are characters called Leighton Jones, Victoria Wilson, Michael Latimer, Brent Andrews, and Warwick Stevens. All these names are taken partly, or in their entirety, from tube stations. The two killers, Linda Cole and Matilda Orr, are both anagrams of Collindale on the Northern Line and Latimer Road. The gay writers make up the cast of Red Roses for Atticus. In Atticus Punt Takes the Case, well, you can work it out for yourself. John Waterman, Parker Bowles Advertising, Caroline Fisher, Carla Visconti, Professor Otto Schneider, Elizabeth Faber. I woke up the next morning, just after 7 o'clock, with a headache and a nasty taste in my mouth. Bizarrely, James's car keys were still clutched in my hand, and for a ghastly moment, I half expected to open my eyes and find him lying next to me. I went into the bathroom and had a long, hot shower. Then I dressed and went downstairs to black coffee and grapefruit juice. I had the manuscript of Magpie Murders with me, and despite my state, it didn't take me long to find what I was looking for. All the characters are named after birds. When I'd read the book for the first time, I'd made a note to tackle Alan about Sir Magnus Pye and Pye Hall. The names had struck me as a little childish, old-fashioned at the very least. They felt like something out of Tintin. Going through it again, I realized that almost everyone, even the most minor characters, had been given the same treatment. There are the obvious ones. The vicar is Robin, and his wife is Hen. Whitehead, antique dealer, Redwing, doctor, and Weaver, undertaker, are all fairly common species, as are Crane and Lanner, the estate agents in Bath, and Kite, the landlord of the ferryman. Some are a little more difficult to pin down. Joy Sanderling is named after a small wading bird, and Jack Dartford after a warbler. Brent, the groundsman, is a type of goose, and his middle name is Jay. A 19th-century naturalist called Thomas Blakiston had an owl named after him and inspires the family at the heart of the story, and so on. Does it matter? Well, yes, actually. It worried me. Character names are important. I've known writers who've used their friends, while others have turned to reference books. The Oxford Book of Quotations and the Cambridge Biographical Encyclopedia are two I've heard mentioned. What's the secret of a good name in fiction? Simplicity is often the key. James Bond didn't get to be who he was by having too many syllables. That said, the name is often the first thing you learn about a character, and I think it helps if it fits comfortably, if it feels appropriate. Rebus and Morse are both very good examples. Both are types of code, and as the role of the detective is effectively to decode the clues and the information, you're already halfway there. 19th century authors like Charles Dickens took the idea a stage further. Who would want to be taught by Wackford Squeers, cared for by Mr. Bumble, or married to Jerry Cruncher? But these are comic grotesques. He was more circumspect when it came to heroes and heroines with whom he wanted you to connect. Some authors stumble onto iconic names almost by accident. The most famous example is Sherrinford Holmes and Ormond Sacker. You have to wonder if they would have achieved the same worldwide success if Conan Doyle hadn't had second thoughts and plumped for Sherlock Holmes and Dr. John Watson. I've actually seen the manuscript where the change is made. One sweep of the pen and literary history was made. By the same token, would Pansy O'Hara have set the world on fire in quite the same way as Scarlet did, after Margaret Mitchell changed her mind when she finished Gone with the Wind? Names have a way of stamping themselves on our consciousness. Peter Pan, Luke Skywalker, Jack Reacher, Fagin, Shylock, Moriarty. Can we imagine them as anything else? The point of all this is that the name and the character are intertwined. They inform each other. But it's not the case in Magpie Murders, or in any of the other books that Alan Conway wrote and which I edited. By turning all his subsidiary characters into birds or tube stations, or makes a fountain pen in Atticus Punt Takes the Case, he had trivialized them, and that, in turn, had demeaned them. Maybe I'm overstating this. After all, his detective stories were never meant to be more than entertainments. It just suggested a sort of carelessness, almost a disdain towards his own work, and it depressed me. I was sorry that I hadn't noticed it before. After breakfast, I packed, paid for the room, then drove over to Abbey Grange to drop off James Taylor's keys. It was strange seeing the house for what I was fairly sure would be the last time. Maybe it was the grey Suffolk sky, but it seemed to have a mournful quality, as if it had somehow sensed not only the death of its old owner, but the fact that it was no longer wanted by his successor. I could barely bring myself to look at the tower, which now seemed grim and threatening. It occurred to me that if ever a building was destined to be haunted, it was this one. Some day, not far in the future, a new owner would be woken in the middle of the night, first by a cry in the wind, and then the soft thud of something hitting the turf. James was absolutely right to leave. I thought of ringing the doorbell, but decided against it. Most likely James was still in bed, and anyway, fueled by alcohol, he might have been more open with me than he had intended. Better to avoid the morning-after recriminations. I had an appointment in Ipswich. Claire Jenkins had been true to her word, and had arranged for me to meet Detective Superintendent Locke, not at the police station, but at a Starbucks near the cinema. I'd received a text with instructions. 11 o'clock. He could give me 15 minutes. I had plenty of time to get over there, but first, I wanted to visit the house next door to Alan's. I had seen John White in his orange Wellington boots at the funeral, but we hadn't yet had a chance to talk. James had mentioned that Alan had fallen out with him, and he had turned up as a character in Magpie Murders. I wanted to know more. This being a Sunday, there was every chance that I would find him at home, so I dropped James's keys through the letterbox, then drove round. Despite the name, there was no sign of any apple trees at Apple Farm, and, nor for that matter, did it look anything like a farm. It was a handsome building, much more conventional than Abbey Grange, built, I would have said, in the '40s. It was all very presentable, with a neat gravel driveway, perfect hedges, and extensive lawns cut into green stripes. There was an open garage opposite the front door, with a quite fabulous car parked outside. A two-seater Ferrari, 458 Italia. I wouldn't have said no to tearing round a few Suffolk lanes in that, but it wouldn't have left me much change out of £200,000. It certainly made my own MGB look a little sad. I rang the front door. I guess the house must have had at least 8 bedrooms, and that, given its size, I might wait quite a time before anyone reached me. But in fact the door opened almost at once, and I found myself facing a round-faced woman with black hair parted in the middle, dressed in quite masculine clothes, sports jacket, tight-fitting trousers, ankle-length boots. Was she his wife? She hadn't been at the funeral. Somehow, I doubted it. "I wonder if I could speak to Mr. White," I said. "Are you Mrs. White?" "No, I'm Mr. White's housekeeper. Who are you?" "I'm a friend of Alan Conway. Actually, I was his editor. I need to ask Mr. White about what happened. It's quite important." I think she was about to tell me to get lost, but at that moment a man appeared behind her in the hallway. "Who is it, Elizabeth?" a voice asked. "It's someone asking about Alan Conway. My name is Susan Ryland." I was addressing him over her shoulder. "It'll only take 5 minutes, but I really would appreciate it." I sounded so reasonable that it would have been difficult for White to refuse me. "You'd better come in," he said. The housekeeper stepped aside, and I went past her into the hall. John White was standing in front of me. I recognized him instantly from the funeral. He was quite small, very slim, and rather nondescript in appearance, with close-shaven dark hair that was reflected by the permanent stubble on his chin. He was wearing an office shirt and a V-neck pullover. I found it hard to imagine him behind the wheel of the Ferrari. There was nothing aggressive about him at all. "Can I get you some coffee?" he asked. "Thank you, that would be nice." He nodded at the housekeeper, who had been expecting this and went off to get it. "Come into the sitting room," he said. We went into a large room that looked over the back gardens. There was modern furniture and expensive art on the walls, including one of those neons by Tracy Emin. I noticed a photograph of 2 attractive-looking girls, twins. His daughters? I could tell at once that apart from the housekeeper, he was alone in the house, so either his family was away or he was divorced. I suspected the latter. "What do you want to know about Alan?" he asked. It all seemed so very casual, but I'd been on Google that morning and knew that this was a man who had run not one but 2 of the most successful hedge funds for a big city firm. He had made a name for himself and a fortune for everyone else by predicting the credit crunch, and had retired at the age of 45 with more money than I would ever dream about if I had those sort of dreams. He still worked, though. He invested millions and made millions more, from clocks, car parks, property, whatever. He was the sort of man I could easily dislike. In fact, the Ferrari made it easier. But I didn't. I don't know why not. Maybe it was those orange hunters. I saw you at the funeral. Yes, I thought I ought to pop along. I didn't stay for the drinks, though. Were you and Alan close? We were neighbours, if that's what you mean. We saw quite a bit of each other. I read a couple of his books, but I didn't much like them. I don't get a lot of time to read, and his stuff wasn't my sort of thing. Mr. White, I hesitated. This wasn't going to be easy. Call me John. I understand you and Alan had a disagreement shortly before he died. That's right. He was unfazed by the question. Why are you asking? I'm trying to work out how he died. John White had soft hazel eyes, but when I said that, I thought I saw something spark in them, a sense of some inner machinery clicking into gear. He committed suicide, he said. Yes, of course, but I'm trying to understand his state of mind when he did it. I hope you're not suggesting. I was suggesting all sorts of things, but I backtracked as gracefully as I could. Not at all. As I explained to your housekeeper, I worked for his publishers, and, as it happens, he left us one last book. Am I in it? He was. Alan had turned him into Johnny Whitehead, the crooked antique dealer who had been sent to prison in London. That was the final finger raised to his erstwhile friend. No, I lied. I'm glad to hear it. The housekeeper came in with a tray of coffee, and White relaxed. I noticed that after she had poured two cups and offered cream and homemade biscuits, she made no effort to leave, and he was happy to have her there. "Here's what happened since you want to know," he said. "Alan and I had known each other from the day you moved in, and like I say, we got along fine. But it went wrong about 3 months ago. We did a bit of business together. I want to make it quite clear to you, Susan, that I didn't twist his arm or anything like that. He liked the sound of it, and he wanted to come along for the ride." "What was it?" I asked. "I don't suppose you know much about my sort of work. I've been dealing a lot with NAMA. It stands for the National Asset Management Agency, and it was set up by the Irish government after the crash of 2008, basically selling off businesses that had gone bust. There was an office development in Dublin that had caught my eye. It would cost $12 million to buy, and it needed another $4 or $5 spent, but I thought I could turn it around. And when I mentioned this to Alan, he asked if he could join the SPV. SPV? Special Purpose Vehicle. If my complete ignorance annoyed him, he didn't let it show. It's just a cost-effective way to bring 6 or 7 people together to make this sort of investment. Anyway, I'll cut a long story short. The whole thing went belly up. We were buying the development from a man called Jack Dartford, and he turned out to be a complete rogue, a liar, a fraud, you name it. I'll tell you, Susan, you couldn't meet a more charming man. He sat where you're sitting now, and he'd have the whole room in stitches. But it turned out he didn't even own the property, and the next thing I know, he's gone west with $4 million of our cash. I'm still looking for him now, but I don't think he's going to be found. Alan blamed you? White smiled. You could say that. Actually, he was bloody furious. Look, we'd all lost the same, and I warned him, going in, you can never be 100% certain in these things. But he got it into his head that I'd somehow ripped him off, which was well out of order. He wanted to sue me. He threatened me. I couldn't make him see sense. When was the last time you saw him? He had been about to take a biscuit. I saw his hand hesitate, and at the same time, he glanced in the direction of the housekeeper. He might have learned how to keep a poker face when he was at business school, but she hadn't been to the same class, and I saw her nervousness, naked and obvious. It signalled the lie that was to come. I hadn't seen him for a few weeks, he said. Were you here on the Sunday when he died? I suppose so, but he didn't contact me. If you want the truth, we were only talking through solicitors, and I wouldn't like you to think that his dealings with me were in any way connected with what happened. His death, I mean. Sure, he lost some money. We all did. But it wasn't anything he couldn't afford. He wasn't going to have to sell up or anything like that. If he couldn't afford it, I wouldn't have let him in. I left soon after that. I noticed that Elizabeth, the housekeeper, hadn't offered me a second cup of coffee. They waited on the doorstep as I climbed into my MGB, and they were still standing there together, watching, as I drove back down the drive. Starbucks, Ipswich. There's a well-marked one-way system that takes you round the edge of Ipswich, which suits me, because it's one city I've never much enjoyed entering. There are too many shops and too little else. People who live there probably like it, but I have bad memories. I used to take Jack and Daisy, my nephew and niece, to the Crown Pools, and I swear to God I can still smell the chlorine. I could never find a space in the bloody car parks. I'd have to queue up for ages just to get in and out. More recently, they'd opened one of those American-style complexes just opposite the station, with about a dozen fast-food restaurants and a multiplex cinema. It seems to me that it kills the city, separating the entertainment like that, but it was here that I met Richard Locke for the 15 minutes he had been kind enough to give me. I arrived first. At 11:20, I had more or less decided that he wasn't going to come, but then the door opened and he strode in, looking pissed off. I raised a hand, recognizing him at once. He was indeed the man I'd seen with Claire at the funeral, but he had no reason to know me. He was wearing a suit, but without a tie. This was his day off. He came over and sat down heavily, all that well-toned flesh and muscle hammering into the plastic chair, and my first thought was that this wasn't someone I'd want to arrest me. I felt uncomfortable even offering him a coffee. He asked for tea, and I went over and got it for him. I bought him a flapjack too. I understand you're interested in Alan Conway, he said. I was his editor. And Claire Jenkins was his sister. He paused. She has this idea that he was killed. Is that what you think? There was a grim, no-nonsense tone to his voice that was actually on the edge of anger. It was in his eyes, too. They were fixed on me, as if he was the one who had ordered this interrogation. I wasn't quite sure how to reply. I wasn't even sure what to call him. Richard was probably too informal. Mr. Locke was wrong. Detective Superintendent felt too TV, but that was the one I plumped for. Did you see the body? I asked. No, I saw the report. Almost grudgingly, he broke off a piece of his flapjack, but he didn't eat it. Two officers from Leyston were called to the scene. I only got involved because I happened to know Mr. Conway. Also, he was famous, and there was obviously going to be interest from the press. Claire had introduced you to him? I think it was the other way round, actually, Miss Ryland. He needed help with his books, and so she introduced him to me. But you didn't answer my question. Do you think he was murdered?
I think it's possible, yes.
He was going to interrupt me, so I went on quickly. I told him about the missing chapter, which had first brought me to Suffolk. I mentioned Alan's diary, the number of appointments he had made for the week after he died. I didn't talk about the people I'd spoken to. It didn't seem fair to drag them in. But for the first time, I explained my feeling about the suicide letter, how it didn't quite add up. It's only on page 3 that he talks about dying, I explained. But he was dying anyway, he had cancer. The letter doesn't actually say anywhere that he's about to kill himself.
You don't think it's a bit odd, then, that he sent it to his publisher one day before he threw himself off that tower?
Perhaps he wasn't the one who sent it. Perhaps someone read the letter and realized that it could be misinterpreted. They pushed Alan off the tower and then sent the letter themselves. They knew we'd leap to the wrong conclusion precisely because of the timing.
I don't think I've leapt to any wrong conclusions, Miss Ryland. He was not looking at me sympathetically, and although I was a little annoyed, the strange thing is that, right then, he was not wrong to doubt me. There was something about the letter which I, of all people, should have noticed, and which I hadn't. I called myself an editor, but I was blind to the truth, even when it was right there in front of my eyes. "There are a lot of people who didn't like Alan," I began.
"There are a lot of people who don't like a lot of people. But they don't go around the place murdering them."
He had come here with the intention of telling me this, and now that he had started, he wasn't going to stop.
"What people like you don't seem to understand is that you've got more chance of winning the lottery than you have of being murdered. Do you know what the murder rate was last year? 598 people. That's out of a population of around 60 million. In fact, I'll tell you something that may amuse you. There are some parts of the country where the police actually solve more crimes than are committed. You know why that is? The murder rate's falling so fast, they've got time to look into the cold cases that were committed years ago." "I don't understand it. All these murders on TV, you'd think people would have better things to do with their time. Every night, every bloody channel. People have some sort of fixation. And what really annoys me is that it's nothing like the truth. I've seen murder victims. I've investigated murder. I was here when Steve Wright was killing prostitutes. The Ipswich Ripper, that's what they called him. People don't plan these things. They don't sneak into their victims' houses and throw them off the roof and then send letters out hoping they're going to be misinterpreted, as you put it. They don't put on wigs and dress up like they do in Agatha Christie. All the murders I've ever been involved in have happened because the perpetrators were mad or angry or drunk. Sometime all three. And they're horrible, disgusting. It's not like some actor lying on his back with a little red paint on his throat. When you see someone who's had a knife in them, it makes you sick. Literally sick. Do you know why people kill each other? They do it because they're out of their heads. There are only three motives: sex, anger, and money. You kill someone in the street, you stick a knife in them, and you take their money. You have an argument with them, and you smash a bottle and rip open their throat. Or you kill them because you get off on it. All the murderers I've met have been thick as shit. Not clever people, not posh or upper class, thick as shit. And you know how we catch them? We don't ask them clever questions and work out that they don't have an alibi, that they weren't actually where they were meant to be. We catch them on CCTV. Half the time, they leave their DNA all over the crime scene, or they confess. Maybe one day you should publish the truth. Although I'm telling you, nobody would want to read it. I'll tell you what really annoyed me about Alan Conway. I helped him. Not that he ever gave me anything by way of a thank you, but that's another story. No. First of all, he wasn't interested in the truth. Why are all the detectives in his book so fucking stupid? You know, he even based one on me. Raymond Chubb. That's me. Oh, he's not black. He wouldn't have dared go that far. But Chubb. You know who they are? They manufacture locks. Get it? And all that stuff he wrote about the wife in No Rest for the Wicked, that was my wife he was writing about. I'd been stupid enough to tell him, and he went ahead and put it in his book without ever asking me. So this was the source of his anger. From the way Locke was talking, I knew he wasn't interested in me, and he wasn't going to help. I might almost have added him to my list of suspects. The public have no idea what the police are really doing in this country, and it's thanks to people like Alan Conway and people like you, he concluded. And I hope you don't mind my saying this, Ms. Ryland, but I find it a little bit pathetic that you're trying to make a real-life mystery out of what is actually a textbook case suicide. He had the motive. He was ill. He wrote a letter. He just split up with his boyfriend. He was alone, so he makes a decision, and he jumps. If you want my advice, you'll go back to London and forget it. Thanks for the tea. He had finished drinking, and he walked out. He had left the flapjack in pieces on his plate. Crouch End. Andreas was waiting for me when I got in. I could tell the moment I opened the door because of the smell coming from the kitchen. Andreas is a fantastic cook. He cooks in a very masculine way,
rattling pans, throwing in the ingredients without measuring them, everything high speed on roaring flames, with a glass of red wine in hand. I've never seen him consult a cookery book. The table was laid for two, with candles and flowers that looked like they'd come from a garden, not a shop. He grinned when he saw me and gave me a hug.
"I thought you weren't coming," he said.
"What's for dinner?"
"Roast lamb."
"Can you give me 5 minutes?"
"I can give you 15.
I showered and changed into a loose-fitting jumper and leggings, the sort of clothes that assured me I wouldn't be going out again tonight. I came to the table with damp hair and picked up the giant glass of wine that Andreas had poured for me. "Cheers."
"Yamas."
English and the Greek. That was another of our traditions. We sat down and ate, and I told Andreas everything that had happened in Framlingham, the funeral, all the rest of it. I knew at once that he wasn't very interested. He listened politely, but that wasn't what I'd hoped for. I wanted him to question me, to challenge my assumptions. I thought we might work it out, like some sort of North London Tommy and Tuppence, Agatha Christie's slightly less successful detective duo. But he didn't really care who had killed Alan. I remembered that he hadn't wanted me to investigate in the first place, and I wondered if I had annoyed him, the Greek side of him, going ahead anyway. In fact, his mind was on other things.
"I've given him my notice," he suddenly announced as he served up.
"At the school? Already?" I was surprised.
"Yes, I'm leaving at the end of term."
He glanced at me.
"I told you what I was going to do."
"You said you were thinking about it."
"Yanis has been pushing me to make a decision. The hotel owners won't wait much longer, and the money is in place. We managed to get a loan from the bank, and there may be various grants available from the EU. It's all happening, Susan. Polydorus will be open next summer."
"Polydorus? Is that what it's called?"
"Yes."
"It's a pretty name." I have to admit, I was a little thrown. Andreas had more or less asked me to marry him, but I'd assumed he would give me a little time to make up my mind. Now, it seemed, he was offering me a done deal. Just bring out the air ticket and the apron, and we could be on our way. He had his iPad with him, and slid it round on the table while we ate, showing me pictures. Polydorus did look a lovely place. It was a long veranda with crazy paving, and a straw pergola, brightly coloured wooden tables, and a dazzling sea beyond. The building itself was whitewashed with blue shutters, and I could just make out a bar with an old-fashioned coffee machine tucked away inside in the shade. The bedrooms were basic, but they looked clean and welcoming. I could easily imagine the sort of people who would want to stay there, visitors rather than tourists.
"What do you think?"
he asked. "It looks lovely."
"I'm doing this for both of us, Susan."
"But what happens to both of us if I don't want to come?" I closed the cover of the iPad. I didn't want to look at it anymore. "Couldn't you have waited a little longer before you went ahead?"
"I had to make up my mind about the hotel, and that's what I've done. I don't want to be a teacher all my life, and anyway, you and me, is this the best we can do?"
He laid down his knife and fork. I noticed how neatly he arranged them on each side of his plate.
"We don't see each other all the time," he went on. "There are weeks when we don't see each other at all. You made it clear you didn't want me to move in with you." I bridled at that.
"That isn't true. You're welcome here. But most of the time you're at school. I thought you preferred it this way."
"All I'm saying is that we could be together more.
We could make this work."
"I know I'm asking a lot, but you won't know until you try. You've never even been to Crete. Come for a few weeks in the spring. See if you like it."
I said nothing. So he added,
"I'm 50 years old. If I don't make a move on this, it's never going to happen."
"Can't Yanis manage without you?"
"I love you, Susan, and I want you to be with me. I promise you, if you're not happy, we can come back together. I've already made that mistake. I'm not going to do it twice. If it doesn't work, I can get another teaching job."
I didn't feel like eating anymore. I reached out and lit a cigarette. "There's something I haven't told you," I said. "Charles has asked me to take over the company." His eyes widened when he heard that.
"Do you want to?"
I have to consider it, Andreas. It's a fantastic opportunity. I can take Cloverleaf in any direction I want.
I thought you said Cloverleaf was finished.
I never said that. He looked disappointed, so I added, is that what you were hoping?
Can I be honest, Susan? I thought when Alan died that it would be the end for you. Yes, I thought the company would close and you would move on, and that the hotel would be the answer for both of us.
It's not like that. It may not be easy for a couple of years, but Cloverleaf isn't going to disappear overnight. I'll commission new authors.
You want to find another Atticus Punt?
He had said it with such scorn that I stopped, surprised. I thought you liked the books. He reached out and took the cigarette from me, smoked it for a moment, then handed it back. It was something we did unconsciously, even when we were angry with each other.
I never liked the books, he said. I read them because you worked on them and obviously I cared about you. But I thought they were crap.
I was shocked. I didn't know what to say. They made a lot of money.
Cigarettes make a lot of money. Toilet paper makes a lot of money. Doesn't mean they're worth anything.
You can't say that.
Why not? Alan Conway was laughing at you, Susan. He was laughing at everyone. I know about writing. I teach Homer, for God's sake. I teach Aeschylus. He knew what those books were, and he knew when he was putting them together. They're badly written trash.
I don't agree. They're very well written. Millions of people enjoy them.
They're worth nothing. 80,000 words to prove that the butler did it.
You're just being snobbish.
And you're defending something that you always knew had no value at all.
I wasn't sure when the discussion had turned into such an acrimonious argument. The table looked so beautiful, with the candles and the flowers. The food was so good that the two of us were at each other's throats. If I didn't know you better, I'd say you were jealous, I complained. You knew him before I did. You were both teachers, but he broke out.
You're right about one thing, Susan. I did know him before you, and I didn't like him.
Why not?
I'm not going to tell you. It's all in the past, and I don't want to upset you.
I'm already upset.
I'm sorry. I'm just telling you the truth. As for the money he made, you're right about that, too. He didn't deserve any of it, not one penny. And all the time I've known you, I've hated the way you've had to kowtow to him. I'm telling you, Susan, he wasn't worthy of you.
I was his editor, that's all. I didn't like him either. I forced myself to stop. I hated the way this was going. Why did you never say any of this before?
Because it wasn't relevant. It is now. I'm asking you to be my wife.
Well, you've got a funny way of going about it. Andreas stayed the night, but there was none of the companionship we'd had on the first night he'd got back from Crete. He went straight to sleep and left very early the next morning without breakfast. The candles had burned down. I wrapped the lamb in silver foil and put it in the fridge. Then I went to work.
Cloverleaf Books.
I've always been fond of Mondays. Thursdays and Fridays make me edgy. But there's something that's quite comforting about coming in to the pile on my desk, the unopened letters, the proofs waiting to be read, the post-it notes from marketing, publicity and foreign rights. I chose my office because it's at the back of the building. It's quiet and cozy, tucked into the eaves. It's a sort of room that really ought to have a coal fire, and probably did once, until some turn-of-the-century vandal filled in the fireplace. I used to share Jemima with Charles before she left, and there's always Tess on reception, who will do anything for me. When I came in that Monday morning, she made me tea and gave me my phone messages. Nothing urgent. The Women's Prize for Fiction had asked me to join their judging panel. My children's author needed comforting. There were production problems with a dust jacket. I'd said it wouldn't work. Charles wasn't in. His daughter, Laura, had gone into labor early as expected, and he was waiting at home with his wife. He'd also sent me an email that morning. I hope you had time to think about our conversation in the car. It would be great for you, and I'm confident it would be great for the company, too. Funnily enough, Andreas telephoned me just as I was reading it. Glancing at my watch, I guessed he must have slipped out into the corridor, leaving the kids with their Greek primers. He was speaking in a low voice.
"I'm sorry about last night," he said. "It was stupid of me just to throw everything at you like that. The school have asked me to reconsider, and I won't make any decision until you tell me what you want to do."
"Thank you."
"And I didn't mean what I said about Alan Conway either. Of course his books are worthwhile. It's just that I knew him and..." His voice trailed off, and I could imagine him glancing up and down the corridor like a schoolboy afraid of getting caught.
"We can talk about it later," I said.
"I've got a parents' evening tonight. Why don't we have dinner tomorrow night?"
"I'd like that."
"I'll call you."
He rang off. Quite unexpectedly, and without really wanting it, I had come to a crossroads, or more accurately, a T-junction in my life. I could take over as CEO of Cloverleaf Books. There were writers I wanted to work with, ideas I had, but which Charles had always vetoed. As I told Andreas the night before, I could develop the business the way I wanted. Or there was Crete. The choices were so different, the two directions so contrary, that considering them, the two of them side by side, almost made me want to laugh. I was like the child who doesn't know if he wants to be a brain surgeon or a train driver. It was quite frustrating. Why do these things always have to happen at the same time? I looked through my post. There was a letter addressed to Susan Ryland, without the E, which I was tempted to bin. I hate it when people misspell my name, especially when it's so easy to check. There were a couple of invitations, invoices, the usual stuff. And at the bottom of the pile, a brown A4 envelope, which clearly contained a manuscript. This was unusual. I never read unsolicited manuscripts. Nobody does anymore. But it had my name on the envelope, correctly spelled, so I tore it open and looked at the front page. "Death Treads the Boards, Donald Lee." It took me a moment to remember that this was the book written by the waiter at the Ivy Club, the man who had dropped the plates when he saw Alan Conway. He claimed that Alan had stolen his ideas and used them for the fourth Atticus Punt mystery, Night Comes Calling. I still didn't like his title very much, and the first sentence, "There'd been hundreds of murders in the Pavilion Theatre, Brighton, but this was the first one that was real." It didn't quite work for me either. A nice idea, but too on the nose, and expressed a little clumsily, I thought. But I had promised him I would read it, and with Charles away, and with Alan so much on my mind, I thought I'd get to it straight away. I had my tea. Why not? I skim-read most of it. It's something I'd learnt to do. I can usually tell if I'm going to like a book by the end of the second or third chapter, but if I'm going to talk about it in conference, I'm obliged to hang in there to the last page. It took me 3 hours. Then I pulled out a copy of Night Comes Calling, and then I compared the two. Extract from Night Comes Calling by Alan Conway. Chapter 26. Curtain Call. It ended where it had begun, in the theatre at Fawley Park. Looking around him, James Fraser had a sense of inevitability. He had abandoned his career as an actor to become the assistant of Atticus Punt, and this was where his first case had brought him. The building was even shabbier than when he had first seen it, now that the stage had been stripped and most of the seats piled up against the walls. The red velvet curtains had been pulled aside. With nothing to conceal, no play about to begin, they looked tired and threadbare, hanging limply on their wires. The stage itself was a yawning mouth, an ironic reflection of the many young spectators who had been forced to sit through the headmaster's productions of Agamemnon and Antigone. Well, Elliot Tweed would not be performing again. He had died in this very room, with a knife driven into the side of his throat. Fraser was not yet used to murder, and there was one thought that chilled him in particular. What sort of a person kills a man in a room filled with children? On the night of the school play, there had been 300 people sitting together in the darkness, little boys and their parents. They would remember it for the rest of their lives. The theatre suited Punt. He had arranged the seats so that they were facing him in two rows. He stood in front of the stage, leaning on his rosewood cane, but he could just as easily have been on it. This was his performance, the climax of a drama that had begun 3 weeks earlier with a frightened man visiting Tanner Court. The spotlights might not be illuminated, but still they bowed their heads towards him. The people he had asked to be here were suspects, but they were also his audience. Detective Inspector Ridgway might be standing next to him, but it was clear that he had been given only a supporting role. Fraser examined the staff members. Leonard Graveney had been the first to arrive, taking his place in the front row, his crutch resting awkwardly against the back of his chair. The stump of his leg jutted out in front of him, as if purposefully blocking the way for everyone else. The history teacher, Dennis Cocker, had come and had sat next to him, although Fraser noticed that neither of them had spoken. Both men had been involved in the last fateful performance of Night Comes Calling when the murder had happened, Graveney as the author of the play, Cocker as its director. The lead part had been taken by Sebastian Fleet. Aged just 21, he was the youngest teacher at Fawley Park, and he had ambled in nonchalantly, winking at the matron, who deliberately turned her head away, ignoring him. Lydia Gwendryth was sitting in the row behind, ramrod straight, her hands folded on her lap, her white starched cap seemingly glued in place. Fraser was still convinced that she had been involved in Elliot Tweed's murder. She certainly had a motive. He had behaved horribly towards her, and with her medical training, she would have known exactly where to place the knife. Had she run through the audience that night, taking revenge for the humiliation she had suffered at his hands? As she sat waiting for Punt to begin, her eyes gave nothing away. Three more members of the staff came in. Harold Trent, Elizabeth Colne, and Douglas Y. Finally, the groundsman Gary arrived, his hands deep in his pockets and a scowl on his face. It was clear he had no idea why he had been summoned. The question we must ask ourselves is not why Elliot Tweed was killed. As the headmaster of Fawley Park, he was a man with more, you might say, than his fair share of enemies. The boys feared him. He beat them mercilessly, and on the slightest pretext. He made no attempt to disguise the fact that he took pleasure in their pain. His wife wanted to divorce him. His staff, who disagreed on so many issues, were united only in their dislike of him. No. Punt's eyes swept over the assembly. What we must ask is this. I have said it from the start. Why was he murdered in this way, so publicly? The killer appears as if from nowhere, and runs the full length of the building, pausing only to strike out with a scalpel taken from the biology laboratory. It is true that it is dark, and that the eyes of the audience are focused on the stage. It is the most dramatic moment of the play. There is a mist, a flickering light, and in the shadow appears the ghost of a wounded soldier, as portrayed by Mr. Graveney. And yet, it is a huge risk. Surely someone will have seen where he comes from, or where he goes. A preparatory school, such as Fawley Park, provides many simpler opportunities for murder. There is a timetable. It is known at all times where everyone will be. How convenient for a killer, who can plan his movements in the sure knowledge that his victim will be alone and that he will be unseen. Indeed, the darkness, the speed with which the crime is committed, results in catastrophe. Inspector Ridgway was of the belief that the assistant headmaster, Mr. Morriston, who was sitting next to Mr. Tweed that night, must have witnessed something, and that he was subsequently killed in order to silence him. Perhaps blackmail had been involved. The discovery of a large amount of cash in his locker would certainly seem to suggest this. We now know, however, that the two men had swapped seats just before the performance began.
Mr. Tweed was several inches shorter than Mr. Morriston, and had been unable to see over the head of the woman who was sitting in front of him as she was wearing a hat. It was Mr. Morriston who was the true target. The death of Mr. Tweed was an accident. And yet, it is strange, because Mr. Morriston was a very popular man. He had often come to the defense of Miss Gwendryth. It was he who chose to employ Mr. Garry in the full knowledge of his criminal record. He was also able to prevent the suicide of a child. It is hard to find anyone at the school who spoke anything but well of John Morriston. Hard, but not impossible. There was, of course, one exception. Punt turned to the maths teacher, but he did not need to name him. Everyone in the room knew who he meant. "You're not saying I killed him," Leonard Graveney barked out the words. He couldn't stop himself smiling. "Of course, it is impossible that you could have committed the murder, Mr. Graveney. You lost a leg in the war, fighting your lot. And you now have a prosthetic. You could not have run through the auditorium. That much is painfully clear. However, you will agree that there was a great deal of enmity between you. He was a coward and a liar. He was your commanding officer in the Western Desert in 1941. You were both involved in the Battle of Sidi Rejek, and it was there that you lost your leg.
I asked more than that, Mr. Punt. I was in hospital, in constant pain for 6 months. I lost a great many of my friends, all of them better men than Major Bloody Morriston could ever hope to be. I've already told you all this. He gave the wrong orders. He sent us into that hellhole and then he abandoned us. We were being ripped apart, and he was nowhere near.
There was a court-martial.
There was an inquiry after the war. Graveney sneered as he spoke the word. Major Morriston insisted that we had acted on our own initiative, and that he had done everything he could to bring us back to safety. It was my word against his. Useful that, wasn't it? All the other witnesses being blown apart.
It must have been a great shock for you to find him teaching here.
It made me sick. And everyone was the same as you. They thought the world of him. He was the war hero, the father figure, everyone's best friend. I was the only one who saw through him, and I would have killed him. I'll give you that much. Don't think I wasn't tempted.
Why did you remain here? Graveney shrugged. To Fraser, he looked worn out by his experiences, his shoulders slumped, his thick moustache drooping.
I had nowhere else to go. Tweed only gave me the job because I'd married Gemma. How else do you think a cripple with no qualifications manages to earn a living? I stayed because I had to, and I avoided Morriston as best I could.
And when he was awarded his medal, when he was given the CBE?
It meant nothing to me. You can stick a piece of metal on a coward and a liar, but it won't change who he is.
Punt nodded, as if this was the answer he had expected to hear.
And so, we arrive at the contradiction that is at the heart of the matter, he said. The only man at Fawley Park with a motive to kill John Morriston was also the one man who could not possibly have committed the deed. He paused. Unless, that is, there was a second person who also had a motive, even the same motive, and who had come to the school with the express purpose of exacting his revenge.
Sebastian Fleet realized that the detective was staring directly at him. He straightened up, the color rushing into his cheeks.
What are you saying, Mr. Punt? I wasn't at C.D. Rejek, or anywhere near it. I was 10 years old, rather too young to fight in the war.
That is indeed the case, Mr. Fleet. Even so, I remarked when we met that you seemed to be unusually qualified to be working as an English teacher in a preparatory school in the middle of the countryside. You received a first from Oxford University. You have youth and talent. Why have you chosen to bury yourself away here?
I told you that when we first met. I'm working on a novel.
The novel is important to you, but you interrupted it to write a play.
I was asked to do it. Every year, a member of the staff writes a play, which the staff also performs. It's a tradition here.
And who was it who asked you?
Fleet hesitated, as if unwilling to provide the answer. It was... Mr. Graveney, he said.
Punt nodded, and Fraser knew that he'd had no need to ask the question. He'd known all along.
You dedicated Night Comes Calling to the memory of your father, he continued. You told me that he had died quite recently.
A year ago.
And yet, it seemed strange to me, when I visited your room, that there was no photograph of him taken in the recent past. Your mother accompanied you on the day that you entered Oxford. Your father was not there, nor was he present at your graduation.
He was ill.
He was no longer alive, Mr. Fleet. Do you think it was not an easy matter for me to discover that a Sergeant Michael Fleet, serving with the 60th Field Regiment of the Royal Artillery, died on the 21st of November, 1941? Will you pretend that he was not related to you, and that it is merely a coincidence that brought you to this school? You and Mr. Graveney had met at the offices of the Honourable Artillery Company in London. He invited you to Forley Park. You both had good reason to hate Morriston. It was the same reason.
Neither Fleet nor Graveney spoke, and it was left to the matron to break the silence. Are you saying they did it together? She demanded.
I am saying that they wrote, created, and conceived Night Comes Calling with the express purpose of committing murder. They had decided to take their revenge for what had occurred at C.D. Rejec. It was Mr. Graveney who, I believe, came up with the idea, and Mr. Fleet who put it into action.
You're talking nonsense, Fleet hissed. I was actually on stage when that person ran through the audience. I was in clear sight of everyone.
No. Everything was constructed to make it seem that you were there. But that is not how it works.
Punt got to his feet, using his cane to lever himself up.
The ghost makes its appearance at the back of the stage. It is dark. There is smoke. He is wearing the uniform of a First World War soldier. He has a moustache identical to that of Mr. Graveney. His face is streaked with blood. He has a bandage around his head. He has very few lines to speak. That is how it has been arranged. It is the power of the writer to make everything work to his own purpose. He calls out one word only, Agnes. The voice, distorted by the attack of the mustard gas, is not difficult to fake. But it is not Mr. Fleet who is on the stage. Mr. Graveney, the director of the play, has been waiting in the wings. And, as planned, the two of you changed places for this one short scene. Mr. Graveney puts on the trench coat, he applies the bandage and the blood. Slowly, he walks onto the stage. The fact that he is limping will not be noticed over such a short distance. And anyway, he is playing a wounded soldier. At the same time, Mr. Fleet has removed the false moustache that he has worn for his performance. He puts on the hat and the jacket, which we will later find abandoned in the well. He runs through the auditorium, passing only to stab the man sitting in seat E23. How can he know that moments before the play began, Mr. Tweed and Mr. Morriston exchanged seats, and that the wrong man will die? It happens very quickly. Mr. Fleet leaves through the main door of the theatre, discards the hat and the jacket, then runs round the side in time to change places once again with Mr. Graveney, who has just exited from the stage. By now, the audience is in an uproar. All eyes are on the dead man. Nobody notices what occurs in the wings,
Of course, the two men are horrified when they discover what has occurred.